Now, to move on, the next two menaces to our freedom come from the use of servers on the internet. And there are two ways that servers can harm us. One is by misusing our data, and the other is by taking away control of our computing. We're all aware that if we give data to servers, they can misuse it. And the previous speaker was talking about how Facebook does some of that. Well, there are four different things that they can do that are bad to the data. They can, to our data. And by the way, when I say to our data, I'm talking about the data that the users knowingly provide to the site. Now, they also do surveillance, but that's a separate issue I already talked about. Well, they can lose your data. They can change your data. They can stop you from getting your data back in a usable form. And they can also show your data to someone you didn't want it to be shown to. Four different issues, actually. Even they all relate to abuse of data, but each one is its own issue, which has to be dealt with differently. First of all, the danger of losing data, well, that can happen by accident. Anybody can lose data by accident because nobody's perfect. So really, you should be keeping multiple copies. And if you're doing that, the danger that somebody's copy gets lost is not so great. For the most part, we can make that particular problem not so bad. Changing your data, well, there is a possible defense about that. If we insist that the sites enable us to get all our data back, we can get it back from time to time and see if the changes in it are the changes we expected. And if we could detect that they've changed our data, they probably won't make a practice of doing so. If we insist on a solution to one of those, it protects us some against the other. But the danger of showing our data to someone we didn't want it shown to is there whenever the data is not published. Now, if you publish the data, that means you're saying everybody can see this. There isn't anybody you said shouldn't see it, so there's no danger. But whenever a site handles data that's meant to be private, it could show that data to somebody else. If it's a U.S. company, then you know it's going to mistreat your data because it's subject to the USAP at Riot Act, the hypocritically named USA Patriot Act. But in a country founded on an idea of human rights, nothing is more unpatriotic and more un-American than this law. But the law says that the police can collect any tangible thing, including any data just about, there may be some exceptions, that the company has about you or me or everybody at once. And we know that the FBI is disobeying that law by exceeding the loose bounds that the law puts on it. There are senators who have been shown the facts and were sworn to secrecy, so they say, we can't tell you the nasty things the FBI is doing, but if you knew, you'd be incensed. So we suspect that they're collecting all the cell phone location data all the time. I would expect that they probably collect all of Facebook's data every week. There's, after all, nothing to stop them. And we know that they've had projects where they wanted to collect all the data in the world and then try to do data mining to find anybody that they want to say is a terrorist suspect or want to try to tempt into trying to be one or whatever. So you should never entrust any data to a U.S. company. And supposedly even non-U.S. subsidiaries of U.S. companies have to obey this. Although how that relates to European data protection laws, I don't know. Which one are they going to obey? I don't know. But the European Union doesn't have a very strong record of standing up to U.S. bullying on these things. It's tried a little bit, but I think it has ultimately backed down and surrendered. So don't give any data to those companies. But what if it's not a U.S. company? Does that mean it's good? Not necessarily. I just don't know. of the policies of other countries. This is why the Freedom Box project is so important. The idea of a Freedom Box is that you can run a little server in your own home where you're protected to the full usual non-virtual world extent of the law from police searches. And if you have your email there, if you send any non-published message from there, at least they can't totally neglect the idea of human rights and collect everything all the time. These threats are well known, and other organizations talk about them, such as the EFF. But the other threat of using a network server is one that most people don't think of. It's the threat that happens if you do your computing in somebody else's server. What happens? You lose control of your computing. It's just as if you ran a non-free program. It's the same result. Although it comes about through a different path. In the case of non-free software, you have a copy of the program, but it's only executable typically. So you can't actually change it without a tremendously hard reverse engineering project. But in the case of software as a service, which is the term we use for doing your computing in somebody else's server, your computing is being done by programs that run in the server, and you can't see them or touch them, which means you're even farther away from being able to change them. It's not merely difficult, it's totally impossible. And it doesn't matter if those programs are free software. Remember, that those programs are free software if the user, meaning whoever runs that server, has the four freedoms. Well, that means he can change them. Doesn't mean you can change them, not the copy that's running in his server. And I can't say you should be able to change the copy running in his server. That's his copy. He's the one who should decide what goes into his copy. But that means that if you do your computing by running his copy, he controls your computing and you don't. And there's just no way around this. The only solution is don't use that. And therefore, I firmly refuse to use that. Now, this applies to a small fraction of all the websites in the world. Most websites only publish things. And when you look at them, you're not doing computing, you're just getting data from them. So this issue doesn't arise. But then if we look at the ones that do non-trivial services, mostly those services are not to do your computing, but rather to communicate with others or publish. So mostly those are not instances of this problem. But there are a few which do. For instance, when I published the first version of the paper which led to this talk, the journal asked me to send my PDF file to a certain server which would convert it to the kind of PDF file they wanted and send it back to me. And I said, I can't do that. That software is a service. I can't let that server do my computing. Well, I found a free program that did the same conversion. They didn't recommend using that free program. They recommended using the service. So I just happened to be thinking about this, so I said no. And I think this might even have been part of why I realized I should put this issue into the paper. And I cited this in the paper. The next threat I want to talk about is voting by computer. You must never use computers for elections because they can never be trusted. If the program that's running in the voting machine is proprietary, that means the election authority does not control that software. Some company does. So that company has the possibility of using that software to rig an election. And there's no way the election authority can verify that that won't happen. This is obviously untrustworthy. But suppose it's free software. That means since the election authority owns this computer and owns the copy of the software, the election authority has control over it. But that's no good either, because you can't trust the election authority not to rig the election. In fact, elections are special because there's nobody you can trust at all. Which is why systems of voting have historically been set up so that nobody is trusted. There are people checking, cross-checking, so that no one is trusted. And with traditional voting systems where you vote on paper, anybody of ordinary intelligence and mental ability can be there and do the checking. But that's not the case once a program is involved. And it doesn't do any good to check the source code of the program before the election. Because how do you know the program running during the election corresponds to that source? These systems have lots of vulnerabilities that you wouldn't notice if you looked at it in a theoretical sort of way. I saw a description of a cryptographic voting system which claimed that it would enable every voter to verify that her vote had been properly counted and that no false dummy votes were added. Well, maybe it would work, but the vulnerabilities in real use of the system might not be within that clever piece of mathematical algorithm. For instance, if you're voting from your computer, and your computer is a zombie, how do you know that the vote that gets sent will be the vote you wanted to send? It could lie to you and lie the other way in talking to the electoral authority. We can't see what all the vulnerabilities are by theoretical thinking. And I think it's a real bad mistake to allow computers any role in voting. The next attack on our freedom is the war on sharing. You see, digital technology makes it easy to copy and share published works. I won't call them content because that term disparages the works themselves, and I appreciate some of those works, so I won't use that term. I hope you will join me in rejecting it. In any case, we can make copies of works and we can share them, we can send them to people over the internet. This is tremendously useful. It's a boon to humanity. But there are certain parties whose profits from their stranglehold on culture would be endangered by this, and they want to make it impossible or too dangerous to share. And they have launched a war on sharing. They want to take away the principal benefit of digital technology from most of us and turn it into a mere pay-per-view delivery system for them. Of course, they do that with digital restrictions management. Digital restrictions management is part of the war on sharing, one of the tactics that they've used. And they have not always lost. Blu-ray discs have DRM that in practice people don't know how to break with free software. And as a result, you must view every Blu-ray disc as pointing a gun at you. Never use them. In fact, you shouldn't use any product that was designed to attack your freedom unless you personally have the means to break the handcuffs. So if you have the forbidden free software that can play a DVD, it's okay to get encrypted DVDs. Otherwise, you should reject them. But that brings me to another tactic that they used. Once they saw that people could break DRM, and some DRM schemes have been broken, they started buying laws to censor software, the first of which was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the U.S., which imposed censorship of software in the U.S. Unfortunately, it has not remained limited to the U.S. The entire European Union forbids the distribution of that program, except Finland. In Finland, a curious court case arose. A court ruled that that program was so widespread that the DVD encryption no longer qualified for the law. It was not considered an effective technical restriction measure, and therefore the program can legally be distributed in Finland. Well, that might be a possible way out if other countries could be convinced to legislate this explicitly. Then it might be a way of sort of defeating the EU directive that requires the censorship. But really, the censorship needs to be abolished. It's just a sign of how the EU is being used by the empire of the megacorporations. And the US and the EU regularly impose such unjust laws on other countries through their free exploitation treaties. Now, these treaties, of course, are the enemies of democracy because they transfer power from the state to businesses. The earliest ones just made it easy for a business to move its production from one country to another, the idea being that that way no country would dare to regulate them, and the businesses could get away with anything they wanted to. More recent ones go even further, and they allow companies to sue the state if it passes a law, perhaps to protect the environment, or public health, or standard of living, or anything important, in a way that decreases the company's profits. Then the company can sue. And essentially, these treaties explicitly place foreign businesses above everything that's actually important. So these treaties must be broken. But one example is that they impose these laws of censorship of software. That didn't do enough. So then they started suing thousands of teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that didn't work out quite as well as they liked, although they did get victories and they did collect a lot of money from people who were scared and settled. And so they started going further and proposed to abolish the basic principle of justice that people should not be punished without a fair trial. And they started purchasing laws to punish people with disconnection from the internet when they are merely accused of sharing. And one of these laws was imposed on the UK, the Digital Economy Act, and a totally unjust law, which has no excuse for existing and no moral authority whatsoever. And part of this is a plan for, well, I know this is a case in France, which adopted a similar law. I think they were the first. But in any case, in France, I'm sure that if you don't have a password on your wireless network, then they punish you. They don't care that it was someone else who actually shared. Now, what is going on here? This is collective responsibility, a tool that tyrants use sooner or later. Once they are imposing unjust laws on the people that the people hate, the next thing they do is they say, you are going to watch this group. If I find that any of them disobeys, I'm going to punish you, so watch them carefully. All these things showing the evil and tyrannical nature of these states. Now, what is the biggest political issue of our time? It's to destroy the empire of the corporations, to restore democracy, to restore to our states the power, the practical power and will to regulate business so that it can't be the master anymore. This is why we need to destroy the free exploitation treaties. Well, the Digital Economy Act is just a piece of this, of course. The empire of the corporations applies to many areas of life, not just to computing. And in fact, it's the dominion of the corporations over states that gave us the financial crisis, because they abolished the regulations that were put in place to stop them from causing a financial crisis. And once they were permitted to do so, lo and behold, they did, figuring that they would get bailed out and profit even more, which they did. And then in another area of life, this empire is preventing us from doing anything to prevent them from roasting our planet and destroying civilization which will probably result in hundreds of millions of people dying because they're not allowed to flee from the countries where they can no longer live because it's too hot or too dry or too wet. So for civilization's survival, we need to destroy the empire of the megacorporations. Computing in some ways is small compared with that, but it needs the same thing. So all these different tactics in the war on sharing are cruel and draconian. They have to be, because when something is useful, good, helpful, and easy, only cruel and draconian methods can stop people from doing it. Sharing is good. If they want people not to share, they've got to use nasty methods. The excuse for these nasty methods is always, the artists will starve. Well, you know, if we leave it up to the copyright system, the artists will starve. They do starve. The existing system is lousy for supporting artists, with a few exceptions. Some stars can get very rich, but remember, those are the few exceptions. For the most part, the existing system is set up to benefit those corporations and use the artists only as an excuse. Now, a few people like J.K. Rowling get so much money that it corrupts them morally, and they want that money more than they want anyone to appreciate their work. They'll even get injunctions telling people, don't read my work, don't appreciate my work. And by the way, in my boycott, I don't say that you shouldn't read those books. I only say you shouldn't buy them. I leave it to the author to order you not to read them. If you want to borrow them and read them, that's fine. Just don't give any money to that author and publisher. So I appreciate some kinds of art. And thus, I want to support the artists. I'd like to support them better than the existing lousy system, which oppresses us in the name of the artists. I'd like to really support them in a way that's compatible with the freedom we ought to have. So here are two methods I've proposed for doing that. One uses tax funds. Either you put a special tax on internet connectivity, or you just use part of the general budget, and you divide the money among artists based on their popularity. Why based on their popularity? Well, that's what the existing system does. I'm just being conservative by not changing that. How do you measure popularity? Well, we shouldn't do it by surveillance of everybody's listening and watching habits, so we should do it by some kind of polling. Once we've measured every artist's popularity, what then? The obvious thing, which others have suggested, is to distribute the money in linear proportion to the popularity of each artist. So if superstar A is 1,000 times as popular as fairly good, fairly successful artist B, then A would get 1,000 times as much money as B. Well, that's not efficient, because it means that in order to give B enough not to need a day job, we have to make A tremendously rich. Inefficient use of our money. So I propose to do it based on the cube root instead. So if A is 1,000 times as successful as B, A will get 10 times as much money as B. This means with the same total, the superstars will get less than they would have, and the ones in the middle will get more than they would have. So this way, we can support a lot of artists adequately with much less money. And each star will still get more than any non-star, but not astronomically more. So this system will be more efficient in two ways. First, because it won't support the corporations that now have this power over us. And second, because it won't be putting such a large fraction of the money into stars. So it'll be much less money than we're spending now, and it'll support artists better. And because it's less money, we don't have to worry about exactly how we get it, because we'll be saving anyway. So that's one proposal. The other is voluntary payments. Suppose each player had a button you could push to send a certain amount of money to the artists. maybe in the UK, perhaps 25p might be good. Each country would adjust this amount to try to maximize the total that gets sent. And you could push it when you like, but nothing forces you, nothing punishes you if you don't. But it'll feel good. And if it's a reasonably small amount of money, lots of people will send it because it feels good, and it's such a small amount of money, they're not going to miss it. But poor people would miss it, so they will never send it, and that's good. We don't need to squeeze money out of poor people to support artists. There are enough non-poor people who will be happy to do so. Now, there are already a number of musicians who are getting a decent income by asking for voluntary payments, much bigger voluntary payments. But I think if we make it easy to send small voluntary payments and efficient, a lot more people will do it. Why wouldn't you give 25p to the artist who made some nice work? Well, mainly because it's too hard. So my proposal is make it easy, and then you would. Now, both of these systems fit perfectly with sharing. The artists will say, yes, please share my work. And they'll know that the more you share their work, the more money they're going to get. I'm not quite finished. There's one more menace to our freedom in the digital society, and that is the things we would do by right in the physical world, we do by sufferance in the virtual world. If you have views to state and you want to print a leaflet to hand out, you can do that. You can even buy a printer and you can print things yourself and hand things out. You can rent a storefront to hand them out from. You can collect money. You can have just put out a can and say, drop in some money. And if people choose to put in some coins or banknotes, you can just accept them. You don't need anybody's cooperation to help you do that. You can just do it. If you have a landline phone and someone calls you, you can say what you want to say, and no one can stop you. But all those things go away once you start doing it with the internet instead. For instance, if you want to distribute copies of a text, you need this cooperation of an internet service provider and a domain name registrar and maybe a hosting service. And they might cut off service to you almost arbitrarily. We found that this was a real danger when the United States government launched a distributed denial of service attack against WikiLeaks. Now I'm making a bit of a joke. What it did is not what we usually mean by distributed denial of service attack. It's just that the words fit. Because the United States started attacking all the services that were being provided to WikiLeaks. And by doing so, proved that anybody powerful enough to make threats could do this to anybody. WikiLeaks had rented an Amazon virtual server. The U.S. threatened Amazon, and Amazon cut off the services to WikiLeaks without a trial. It's effectively arbitrary. And then domain names were taken away, but they couldn't destroy all of them. And then Amazon was receiving money through PayPal, so the U.S. threatened PayPal, and PayPal said it would not transmit money to WikiLeaks anymore. And then Visa and MasterCard said they would not transmit money to WikiLeaks. And not only that, they cut off others who said they would accept money on behalf of WikiLeaks. And they were able to do this because in cyberspace, you have no rights. Whatever you're doing it on sufferance, and the companies whose cooperation you need to do anything can take it away. We need to establish by law that they may not cut off anybody's service as long as he keeps paying, just as is the case now in many countries with landline telephones. The phone company can't shut off your phone line because it doesn't like what you're saying. Just as in most cases, if you rented a store, the landlord can't kick you out at any time because he doesn't like the particular things you're distributing from that store. If you signed a lease, then as long as you keep paying and don't do certain other specific forbidden things, you can keep using that store and he can't kick you out. It's got to be the same way for all of the virtual equivalents of the things we do in physical space, or we will have no human rights at all in cyberspace. Now, there is a company that was collecting money on behalf of WikiLeaks, and Visa and MasterCard cut off service to it. And the owner discovered that according to European Union law, because Visa and MasterCard together have almost total control over that particular service, they're not allowed to disconnect service to somebody without going to court. So he sued them. And if he wins, I'm not sure what he will win. I'm not sure whether he will be able to force them to reestablish service to him or whether he'll only be able to get damages for what he lost. Because, you see, his clients weren't able to pay him by credit card either. So he did lose something. But I'm not sure what he can gain this way. I don't know if he can right the wrong or only make them pay him some money. If all he achieves is to make them pay him some money, it won't fix the problem. If he can force them to turn the service back on for him, then it will mean that the European Union has partly corrected this problem. It's got to be fully corrected. So now I would like to mention that there are some stickers here which are gratis, and I also have some pins and key rings and various sizes of buttons for sale, and the money supports the Free Software Foundation. However, to fully support us, you should join. The FSF has only around 2,600 members. We need more. What we can do is directly limited by this. You can join via fsf.org. You can also join the Free Software Foundation Europe via fsfe.org.